Well, we welcome Josh.
Thank you.
I have heard interesting things about you, Josh.
Hopefully good things.
let me just tell you a little bit about Josh's sort of recent, what he's doing now. Is Josh is the pastor at Woolwich Congregational Church.
Yep.
And other than that, I just know you've been in Afghanistan, you were in the army before that.
I was, yeah.
I don't know, I've nothing else.
Okay.
So I'm going to just let you get on with it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. As some of you know, my wife Danielle, who's sitting there, used to attend this church. I think about, what was it now, 8 or 9 years ago. So it's nice for her to be back, and it's nice for me to come and finally see the inside of a building I've heard so much about. And thank you again for coming out to listen to me tonight. I really hope I won't bore you. I know that we've all just eaten, so if you do want to nod off, I won't hold it against you. But what I'll do is sort of tell you the main point of my talk now. So if you want to nod off, you can. Okay. What I want you to know tonight is that whatever you're going through in your lives, whatever you're facing, because, you know, we've got quite a few people here, I'm sure we're all facing a variety of different things. I want you to know that God, firstly, exists, and secondly, that he can be trusted. And in fact, he's more trustworthy than any other person or thing or organization or anything on this earth. Okay, I want you to know that God can be trusted. So if you want to nod off now, you can, and I won't hold it against you, but hopefully you won't. So late February 1985, a baby boy lies in a hospital incubator. The doctors say that this baby is going to die. Why do they say this? Well, he was born very, very prematurely. So prematurely, in fact, that he's like so tiny that the parents have to buy like big teddy bears and take the teddy bear's clothes off to put on the baby, because baby clothes are just way too big for this little child. And his lungs haven't had the time to fully form properly. And as I say, all the doctors and specialists who were called in said to the mother and father, "I'm very sorry, but your son is going to die." But the parents are Christians. And they know that even though the odds don't look good, ultimately the life of this child hangs not in the prognosis of doctors, but in the hands of Almighty God. So one night they are praying for him, and the mother and father are in separate areas. The mother's in the maternity bit, the father's in the visitor's area, and there are three families in the baby's church, all in their individual houses, praying for this boy. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, every single one of them, in all five of the different locations they're in, get an overwhelming sense of peace from God that their prayers have been answered. All of them in different... They didn't even speak to each other that night, but all of them, when they swapped stories later, they all were stunned to find that each one of them had got the answer to prayer at 2 o'clock in the morning. So they thank God and go to bed. The next morning, the doctor walks in and sees the father beaming by the incubator. And the doctor's sort of thinking, "Why are you happy? Your son is probably about to die." And the father says, "No, I believe that God healed my son last night." And again, you can imagine the doctor's reaction to that. So the doctor pulls out the graph, which has charted the baby's heart rate and breathing. And from 2 o'clock in the morning, the graph goes straight up. So that baby came to be known as the miracle baby. And some of the doctors involved in the situation actually became Christians as a result. And the parents called the baby Joshua, which some of you will know means God is Saviour. And of course, that's me. I'm a lot bigger and fatter than I was then. I was very, very tiny, but I'm bigger now. But yeah, so I guess you could say that my entire life, even when I wasn't old enough or able to understand anything at all, I've known that God can do amazing things and that God can be trusted. Well, fast forward a number of years later, I'm on the train home back from Wales, and I'm very, very depressed because I have just finished my time in the parachute regiment. The parachute regiment, along with the Royal Marines and the SAS, is sort of one of the most elite units in the UK, and I had the privilege of serving with them for a number of years, including deploying to Iraq. And I got told to join like the special, basically there's three battalions, one reserve battalion of the parachute regiment. And the one para, which is the first battalion, is sort of like the most elite. They work with the SAS. They're part of a group called the SFSG, which is a Special Forces Support Group. And I had been invited to join that battalion. I was like so happy because I thought like, this is it, you know, I'm going to like get to join the SAS one day and it's great. But God had other plans. I was a Christian. God had saved me a few years beforehand. But he threw a massive spanner in the works that I didn't see coming. We were doing a jump into Holland. And for the history buffs amongst you, you'll know that Operation Market Garden was quite a major operation in World War II, where lots of Allied paratroopers dropped into Holland. The mission was a bit of a disaster. We took a lot of casualties and ultimately weren't particularly successful in that operation itself. But the bravery of the paratroopers involved earned a lot of gratitude from the Dutch people. And every year, British, some Polish and some American paratroopers go and jump into Arnhem, Holland. If any of you have seen The Bridge Too Far, that's what the film is based on. So we were travelling. It's a really good way to travel, actually, because you get on a Hercules aircraft in the UK, you fly over the channel, jump out, land in a field, and then go to a pub or a restaurant and stuff. There's no passport control or anything like that. It's a really nice way to travel. But when we jumped, when we were doing our training jumps, we were told that if the wind was ever higher than 13 knots, you couldn't jump. Now, I still don't know what a knot is to this day, but I know that if it was over 13 knots, you couldn't jump. And when we were flying over the channel to Holland, we were told, oh, the wind's gusting at like 21, 22 knots. So we all thought, oh, this could be unpleasant. But there were thousands of Dutch people had turned out. It was the 65th anniversary of Market Garden, so we had to jump. And I jumped out, and when you first leave the plane, it's terrifying. You know, you're hit by the slipstream, and you're being buffeted, and you're praying your parachute's going to open. And when it does, it's like, it's a painful tug in the groin area, but it's like really reassuring. You're like, oh, fantastic, the parachute's open. And it's like really peaceful. You're drifting down, and you're seeing your friends to the left and right of you. But I saw that today particularly, I was coming down like really, really fast, far quicker than I thought I would be. And some guys were like landing near trees and stuff. And I just hit the ground and I just felt this pain in my knee. It wasn't like a sharp pain at all, but it was just something wasn't quite right. And I tried to shrug it off, and we were deploying, getting ready to deploy for a special forces mission in Afghanistan at the time. And throughout the training, my legs started getting worse and worse. And I was, you know, praying to God, Lord, please, like, don't take this away from me. I love this. This is all I want to do with my life. Please don't take this away from me. And so often in life, God has other plans. You know, I'm sure looking around, there are many people in this room who have seen more years than I have. And I'm sure you will have your own tales of times in your life where perhaps God has taken you in a direction that you didn't see coming at all. And our first reaction when that happens can often to be what I call toddler mode. You know, I've got a little boy. He's not a toddler anymore now. He just started reception a few weeks ago. But, you know, he would often want things. Actually, he still does. And if we don't give them to him, sometimes he can cry and get angry and throw a tantrum and go off and sulk. And we can be like that with God, can't we? When God changes something in our lives, or when something happens that we didn't see coming that's like bad, we can often think, God, why are you letting this happen to me? You know, I had my plan, I had it all worked out, and you have just messed it up. So even though I was a Christian, having become a Christian a few years earlier, I started to sort of hold it against God. And it embarrasses me to even say it now, like how stupid and foolish I was. But toddler mode massively engaged. And I sort of was almost like, well, God, if you're going to treat me like that, I'm not going to bother about you. And as I say, it really embarrasses me to even like talk about it. And you know, I was like chasing drink and girls and getting up to all sorts of horrendous things because I just sort of wanted to erase the pain I was feeling that my friends were going to war and I was left at home. Well, a few months later, my knee had sort of been rehabilitated to a stage where I could play football. I couldn't really do like full paratrooper stuff, but I could play football, and I'd left the army because I didn't really want to join any other unit. And I got a call from a friend who told me that they were looking for cameramen to go to Afghanistan. Now, I wasn't like a trained journalist or anything. When I deployed to Iraq as a soldier, I'd kept like a really small rubbish camera in my pocket. And I made a documentary about what it was like to be a soldier in Iraq. And I just made it for my friends and I's memories, really. But somebody from the BBC saw it and they really liked it. And the BBC showed it on TV, I think it was like September 2007. So in the interview for this Afghanistan job, I turned up and I sort of said, look, I'm not a trained journalist, but here's a documentary I made in Iraq. I know how to conduct myself in a war zone. Please, can I have the job? And on the way to the interview, sort of, I was doing the reverse of toddler mode, where it's just like, oh, Lord, please, you know, even though I'd completely ignored God for the last few months, I was just like, oh, Lord, please give me this, and then I'll, you know, I'll really, like, reform my life. Again, guys, if your Christianity sounds familiar to that, just don't do it, okay? It's just stupid. It's awful. Like, there's nothing in the Bible about that, okay? So just do not do it. It is wicked. They gave me the job, and there was like four of us on the team. And our role was sort of to go to Afghanistan and to film everything, the good stuff and the bad stuff. Now, really, the only thing the media is interested is the bad stuff. You know, they want the bombs and killings and stuff like that. If like a well gets built in a village that has never had like a well before, or a girl, like a, you know, a 12-year-old girl gets to go to school for the first time ever because the Taliban didn't let her, the media don't want any good stuff. They only want the bad stuff. So our job was to film everything and then give it away for free to the international media. We were employed by NATO, and their sort of desire, I guess, was to have both the good news and the bad news coming out, just to show that their mission there wasn't a total disaster. So that was their intention. And because I was the only former soldier in the team, the rest of them were sort of cameramen, camerawomen, journalists and stuff, I sort of took it upon myself to be like, so, you know, I'm going to do the combat, guys. You can go and film the wells and the schools. I want to do the combat. Because really, in conflict zones, all the glory you get, both as a soldier and as like a reporter as well, come through combat, you know, like, so I'm sure you've all seen those war films, you know, when like the new bright-eyed and bushy-tailed recruits turn up, and then they, you know, they see the guys on their base that have been through combat, and those guys are really cool, and these guys are like just very wet behind the ears. That's sort of what it's like to a degree. And I really wanted, because I still hadn't been in like proper combat yet. It sounds like crazy to even think of the fact I wanted to be in it. But when I did A-level, English was one of the A-levels I did, and we did war poetry. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with like Sassoon and Owen and some of the amazing poets from there. And I used to always think, like, if I was in that situation with somebody trying to shoot me, what would I do? You know, would I have the courage to do what I had to do, or would I curl up in a ball and start crying? I think it would probably be the latter one. I mean, like, I never played sports at school. I was like a real wimp, and when I was only ever allowed to play one rugby game, and I just sort of walked around the field thinking about Star Wars. I didn't really try and get involved in the game very much. But I just had this like burning question, like, what would happen if I was in combat? How would I react to that? So you'd sort of think that, you know, even though I got the job I wanted, that I would start to, like, you know, be seeking God and again, but I didn't, you know. It was just, again, any reformation that I had in my heart was just a very surface level thing. And within, like, days of being landing in Afghanistan, I had, you know, just sort of fallen away from God again. I had a Bible with me. I didn't even touch it for the first year I was there. It was really weird, but I'd sort of made chasing combat my God. Okay, and now what do I mean by that? I mean, it was the thing that I wanted to be defined by. It was the thing that I thought if I got it, it would make me happy and satisfied. And it was the thing that I staked my happiness on. Now, again, we can look back in sort of the Old Testament in the Bible and look at those people that like bowed down to gods of like wood and stone. And we can just think, you idiots, how could you do that? And yet we can easily find things in our lives now that sort of fit the criteria I just listed there. You know, things we think, oh, if only I could marry that person or get that house or get that job or get that car, if only I could get that thing, then I'd be happy. Okay, that's not true. You'll get it and you won't be happy. You want something else. Okay, so that's sort of like a God. Something that you stake your happiness and your hope, because the only thing as a human being, the only thing you're designed to hope for and really want and really be satisfied by is God. I can tell you that from experience. There is nothing else on this earth that can truly satisfy you. But at that stage, I was blind, I was lost, and I was thinking if I could just get some combat footage and you know, everyone would be seen throughout the world and everyone would think, oh, wow, he's like cool. And, you know, it was, oh, I'm embarrassed to say it. But it was really funny. For the entire year I was there 3 years in total, but the entire first year, whenever I went to an area where there was combat, it would just fall silent, you know, for the duration of time I was there. And as soon as I'd leave, it would often start again. The first few times it happened, I thought, oh, that's unfortunate. But after about a year of it just happening all the time. I'd become this like walking peace bubble. If I'd sort of cloned myself and spread myself throughout the country, the war would have finished in a day because nothing would have happened. And all my other friends who weren't necessarily looking for the combat, you know, were getting in it and their footage was seeing everywhere. And I started to get so resentful and bitter and toddler mode started engaging again, saying, oh, Lord, why won't you give me what I want? Well, do you know what? I can completely see why he didn't, because I was living in a disgraceful way and I wasn't honoring him at all. But about a year in, it was my birthday, and I'm sure like many of you, when it's your birthday, you sort of look back at the last year you've had, look at your life. And I, even though I had my Bible there, I hadn't touched it at all, but I opened it up at Matthew 6, where Jesus is talking about worrying. And he says, if you're a Christian, if you truly follow me, don't worry about food and clothing. Now, those are actually like important things you could say to worry about, not like combat footage or stuff. And he says, don't worry about those things if you follow me. Seek first my kingdom. Put me first, and everything you need will be given to you. Now, that's not like saying, okay, Lord, I need a Ferrari, so I'm going to put you first. No, in the same way my like 4-year-old thinks he needs chocolate sometimes just before bed, I know exactly he needs exactly the opposite. Okay, if he has that before bed, it's not going to help him at all. So God, as our loving Heavenly Father, he knows exactly what we need. And often what we think we need is actually what he knows we do not need. So, and you know, when I read those verses, I was just cut to the heart. And God, in that moment, just sort of transformed my life and just showed me how vain and stupid and empty my life had become, chasing after these things which I thought would make me happy, and yet they would not. And I burst into tears and I repented. And I was like, Lord, like I don't even deserve to be able to speak to you right now. Like, I deserve to be in hell and that's it. But Lord, I'm so sorry. And in that moment, my whole desire for chasing combat footage and stuff, it just evaporated. And I said, Lord, even if I'm going to film wells for the rest of my life, that's completely fine. Because the peace of knowing you and being right with you is so much better than anything else this world can offer. Well, a week later, I was in Helmand province. I'm sure you guys have heard of Helmand a lot. It's where the British army was primarily based. And I was in a village with some Estonian soldiers. They're from a tiny little nation next to Russia. There's only about 150 of them in Afghanistan. And we were ambushed by the Taliban, who were just up the streets ahead of us. And I remember the time that a bullet first went past my head. It's a horrible sound. In films, bullets sort of go like, pew! And they do make that sound in real life, but it's also like, it's really nasty, like, crack! Like a whip is being cracked right next to your eardrum. And I was just terrified. Like, it's the first time I'd ever been shot at. And the only cover we had was in front of us. So we actually had to run towards them and then duck away into a side alley with a wall there. And a guy near me got shot in the leg. And I remember when I'd been a paratrooper, we had to do like loads of long runs all the time. And I always used to imagine, you know, if somebody got shot near me, I'd like run in slow motion and, you know, I'd be the hero. But I wasn't. Like, I got my bandage out for this guy. Because of the adrenaline in my system, my hands were like this. And he just looked at me and said, give it to me, mate. And just did it and just started bandaging himself. So that was my hero moment. And I ended up just filming him doing it. But it was like a really intense bit of combat. Another guy got shot in the chest, but his plates stopped it. And there were so many Taliban who were sort of trying to encircle us and cut us off. We just had to like run out of the village and call in an airstrike on them. And it was essentially like a week or a week and a half of just combat every day. They were hitting us. There was like a minibus of civilians that got blown up nearby because the Taliban were trying to hit us. And they just laid IEDs everywhere. And a civilian minibus hit it. And lots of them were injured and killed. It was really, really awful to see. About a week later, we were in the middle of this like open field. And we had some Afghan soldiers with us. The whole aim of the mission there is to train up the Afghan soldiers so they can take over security properly. I personally don't think that will ever happen, but that was the aim of the mission. And again, we were ambushed by about 40 Taliban. And in the entire 3 years I was there, I don't think I was ever so scared as I was in this moment. Like, the bullets were landing all around us. A lot of the Afghan soldiers just threw their weapons away and were just lying like starfish in the ground, just trying to like will themselves to sink deeper into the mud. And we heard the worst thing over the radio that you could hear at that time, man down. One of the British soldiers with us had been shot. The bullet had gone into his jaw and out the other side here. And he was just lying prone in the middle of this field. And it was amazing. There was a 21-year-old girl called Kate. She's only about that tall. She was a Navy medic attached to the platoon. And she just ran out on her own under enemy fire and started stabilising him. She won a military cross for it, actually, which was completely well-deserved. And they started asking for volunteers to go out and carry this guy. And I just thought he'd be carrying a body because I thought he'd be dead by then. But I found myself volunteering with a few other guys. And I don't know why, because I was, like, absolutely petrified. But I found the idea of just getting up and running being a bit better than just lying there waiting to get hit because we weren't in any cover. So I got up and started running, and I remember there was an Afghan soldier in front of me running really slowly, and I was just like furious in my mind that he was just so slow. I was like, oh man, I'm going to get killed because of you. But I was just like praying, and all I could like articulate in my mind was just like, Jesus, Jesus, not like blaspheming, but just I couldn't articulate a prayer. I was so scared, so convinced I was going to die the next second. I was just praying. And I, at that moment, I could sort of see why God had held me back from combat until I was right with him, because I don't know how it would have been like, you know, going into that knowing that I was, you know, essentially spitting in God's face by the way I was acting. But in that moment, it was amazing. I just had this real peace from God just take over. And there's a verse in Joshua, I like the book of Joshua, chapter 1, verse 9. And God's talking to Joshua and he says, do not be afraid, do not be dismayed, for I, the Lord your God, are with you wherever you go. And that verse just came to me, just popped into my head in that time, and I was just reciting it. And it was amazing to know that God was there with me in that moment. Now, I didn't know, you know, that didn't mean he was necessarily going to see me through. I could have got shot dead any second. But I knew that he was with me. And if God is with you, and if you're loving him and he's loving you, nothing can separate you from his love. Even a bullet to the head will not separate you from his love. And again, I don't know what you guys in this room are facing. I don't know if anybody's facing cancer or terminal illness or like a terrifying year. But if you are in a relationship with God, if you've repented of your sins and you're walking with him, nothing on earth can separate you from his love. Even if you're going to die tomorrow, it doesn't matter because you'll only go to be with him, which is infinitely better than life we had here. And I was so grateful that he reminded me of that verse as I ran towards the guy. So we reached him. His face was green. I thought, again, he was dead. But she had managed to like shove like a tube because his tongue was like, and blood was like clogging up his airways. But she managed to put like a tube down there, which helped him to breathe. And then we just had to carry him out. And I had to pick up her rifle and we just had to carry him out. And it was irrigation season. It was like March time. So the ground was really soft and it was like sucking us up. It was like some of the hardest physical exercise I think I've ever done in my life. But we got him out and the helicopter came and rescued him and they rebuilt his face. And he actually went back to Afghanistan a year or so later. So yeah, I don't think he learned his lesson. And it was funny that, like, when I got back from the mission, you know, like, my footage was being shown everywhere. Everyone was like, wow, this is some of, like, the best combat footage we've seen. And, like, a year before, I probably would have traded my right arm for that. But, you know, it just didn't even matter that much. It was nothing compared to the joy of knowing God again and just having him abiding in my heart. And again, do you know, I could stand here with Cristiano Ronaldo. I don't think Cristiano Ronaldo is a Christian. And if he isn't, and I don't think he is, I could tell you, despite the money he's making and the good looks he has, I'm happier than he is. I'm more satisfied than he is because all he has is the things of this world. And any Christian in here, myself included, has the Lord, which is so much greater. And then after that, in the summer, I got to be the only video camera on like the largest US Marine air assault since Vietnam. They dropped like thousands of Marines into parts of Helmand nobody had been in. And again, a year before, would have given my right arm to have been the only video camera on that. Like, you know, loads of people throughout the world were seeing my footage on like nightly broadcasts. But again, it was like, yeah, it's all right, but it's nowhere near as important or satisfying as knowing the Lord. Well, I'm a born warrior. And the next thing I started to worry about was, how would I ever meet a wife in Afghanistan? You know, the women were covered in burqas. We have somebody here who used to live in Afghanistan in the 60s, and it actually wasn't like that. The women used to dress like quite normally, like Western normally, but it all changed when Islam really took hold over the country. And, you know, the chance of meeting women in Afghanistan were literally zero. Like my dad, I'm losing my hair. And I started to, like, we had very limited internet bandwidth in Afghanistan, but I spent a good chunk of mine Googling, you know, do women find bald men attractive? And looking at pictures like Vin Diesel or Jason Statham or Bruce Willis and thinking, well, maybe it is, like, maybe you can get away with it. But if God had taught me anything that year, it was that he knows what is best for me. He knows what I need. And again, if what he decided for me in terms of what I needed was a life of singleness, then I would have to say, amen, I trust you, God. Even though I might not want it, you know what's best for me. And again, that's what God calls us to do in the Christian life. It's to trust him in the same way a little toddler like holds up its hand to its father. And the father just says, trust me, son. I know where we're going. So I decided not to Google that anymore and just trust God. Well, unknown to me, Danielle here she'd moved back home because, as you know, her father Don, who some of you would have known, took up a pastor position in Eltham, where we're from. And so she moved back in with her parents. Like me, she'd fallen away from God and had found herself several months pregnant. And you know, I always find it funny, like the stigma that comes with that, because the way I was behaving, you know, chasing girls and stuff, I was far, far worse. But, you know, it's weird culturally that men often sort of get away with it. People, like, look at the women and think, you know, I don't think that's fair, to be honest. Like, we're both massively sinning, I think me more so than her. So, but anyway, her friends had said, you know, get rid of the baby, you know, have it aborted, live an easy life. And she said, no, even though I've fallen away from God, I'm going to repent, turn to him. And even though it might mean I might be single for the rest of my life with this baby, I want to honour God and I want to trust him. So she had moved back in, and I got to come home sort of every 4 months for like a week or two. And I went round to their pastor's house, which is really weird because my dad used to be the pastor of the church. So it was going back to my old house where a new family were living. She opened the door, and immediately at that stage, I sort of thought, oh, she's quite nice. But I sort of left it a while. It was sometime I was in Sangin. In Helmand. I don't know if any of you have heard of Sangin. Helmand was sort of like the worst part of Afghanistan. Sangin was the worst part of Helmand, okay? It's where we lost the most soldiers, had the most life-changing injuries. It's a horrendous place. And we were in the middle of this tiny patrol base, which is about two times the size of this church. And there was a Taliban sniper in the area called Gulab. And I knew he was called Gulab because they used to use these like really rubbish walkie-talkies that you buy from Argos for like a fiver or something. And you could just tune in your ones to their frequency and then have an interpreter tell you what they're saying. And, you know, whenever you'd go out of the base, he would say, right, I can see them in the field. And you look around, oh, we're in the field. And then you go onto the road. I can see them on the road. It's like, where is he? You know, it's really scary. And he'd actually killed two soldiers the week before I arrived, and he'd injured a few more. And he was becoming so much a problem that they sent this, like, SAS sniper. He was just called Master Sniper, and he had his face covered. Apparently, he was, like, the best sniper in the UK. And his job was to hunt Gulab down while we provided the bait. And because I wanted, like, the footage, because I'd been sent there to get footage, I had to go out with each patrol. And, yeah, it would be like clockwork. You'd be out there, and he'd say, right, I see them. And he'd be like, oh, get ready. You know, I pulled my neck muscles so many times that week because I was just like this the whole time, getting ready to duck the moment he started shooting. And I think it was like the 8th, 9th, 10th, I lost count, like time he'd shot at us. I was just lying in the ditch, and I thought, do you know what, if I survive this, I'm going to ask Danielle out for a coffee when I get back because, like, life's just too short. Life really is too short for this. So I got back home, and it was like we used to spend one Christmas in Afghanistan, one Christmas at home. So it was my turn to be at home, and we went for a coffee date. And walking to a house, you know, I was, like, really nervous. I was far more nervous than I was when I'd been shot at and stuff because I'm really a really shy person and really bad at talking to girls and stuff. So, I was just saying, Lord, like, you know, Lord, you've shown me If you show me anything this year, Lord, I know that you can be trusted. I know that you know what's best for me, even if I don't. So, Lord, if you want this to happen, and if she's the right one, then please, Lord, make it so. And we went for a lovely coffee date that turned into lunch, that turned into, I think, a movie date in the afternoon, then dinner in the evening. And I think we both sort of really fell for each other right away. And the baby was still due in a few months' time. And I sort of, you know, quite naively thought, well, you know, like, I've been at war. Like, how hard could a baby be compared to, you know, like, phew, babies are tough. I knew that when I said goodbye to her, because I had just stupidly, the day before we went on the date, I'd signed a contract to be there for another year. It probably wasn't the best move. But I noticed when it was time to say goodbye that everything had changed for me. Like, it broke my heart to get on the plane. I actually cried at the airport. Like, I never, ever cry in public, but we were both crying at the airport, and Mum and Dad were there, and they were crying. And it was, like, really, really bad. And suddenly I found that because I had something to lose, of course, you know, I had Mum and Dad and brothers and sisters before, but it's a lot different to, you know, really, like, loving somebody and imagining the rest of your life with them. Because I knew already, like, I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. And I was really just terrified, you know. I wanted to just film Wells stories, you know. I didn't want to go anywhere near Helmand, anywhere near the fighting. But unfortunately, the previous year, because my footage had gone down quite well, they kept saying, right, Josh, come down for this mission. I was like, no, I want to film Wells. And they were like, no, you need to come down. And my bosses would be like, you got to go. So it became, like, really terrifying. And A couple of months later, it was a night before another major operation. We were going to be dropped into Taliban territory at 4 a.m. the next morning. And I phoned her up to say goodbye. I didn't know if I was going to even be alive the next day. And it was the worst thing that could have happened. She was in the background screaming. Her mum was on the phone. Some of you probably know her mum, Melody. And they were in an ambulance. She had gone into early labor. The baby, I think, was due a month on from then, but she'd gone into early labor. And for me, about to go on a mission, like in a few hours' time, it was the worst thing I could have heard, you know. Your head's got to be in the game when you're there, and you're thinking about the person you love and care about going through this, and the baby, you know, because already at that stage I sort of knew she was the one for me. This baby that I'd like be the dad of not being there, and it was the worst thing that could have happened to me. And I was in Camp Bastion at the time, it was night time, and I just sat down on a tyre and was just crying, and I was so glad that it was dark so no soldiers could see me crying. And again, like toddler mode started to rear its ugly head. I was like, oh God, it seems like you've designed the perfect way to hurt me here. You know, like, why couldn't this have happened a week ago? Yeah, sure, it would have hurt, but right now, before this mission, really? Like, right now? And again, there are so many times in our life where the inopportune moment strikes and we're just like, God, have you really let this happen at this moment? Like, what are you doing? And you don't want to question him, but you sort of think, what's going on here? And do you know what was amazing? A soldier came up to me and he had a dog tag. You know, the dog tag, the ID discs that soldiers wear around their neck in case they get so badly blown up, they need to be identified. And he said, oh, Josh, I found this in the sand. It's yours. And I said, no, mine. I checked, mine was still around my neck. And he said, no, it's yours. It's got your name on it. So I took it, and do you know what was written on it? It said Joshua, yes, he was right, but it said Joshua chapter 1, verse 9. Do not be afraid, do not be dismayed, because I, the Lord your God, are with you wherever you go. Now, there's about, at the time, because Obama had done a surge of troops, there were about 100,000 soldiers in Helmand. What was the odds that one of them, I was only known to about 150 of them, what was the odds that somebody would find this in the sand, associate it with me completely wrongly, thinking just it's got the same name as me, therefore it's mine, and give it to me at that moment? I'm sorry, that's not a coincidence. And God was showing me, even in that darkest moment, the most pain I've probably ever experienced emotionally before, he said, I am still with you. I still love you, and I will still be with you wherever you go. This is the God we can trust in. And unknown to me, they put hormone patches on Danielle's belly. No idea how it works, but they stopped the birth. And I went on the mission, and it was horrible. I remember like flying back to the base afterwards. There was like a dead body at my feet, and his blood was like oozing onto my boots. And it was awful. And I just really thought, like, I don't want to be in this place anymore. And I came back, and my boss felt so sorry for me. He spoke to my colleagues and said, look, it's not your turn to have leave, but go home for a week. You know, the baby hasn't been born yet. Go home for a week and just, like, see her, spend time with your family, because I think you need to. It's really, really kind of him to do that. So we did, and, you know, we were desperate because the birth date was really, like, coming up now. And we were desperate. Even though, you know, the baby wasn't mine, I was really, like, you know, like, I want to be his dad. And I proposed to her, and, you know, we were really excited about the future. And we were both so desperate for the baby to come in this week. So we started Googling, you know, eat curries and go on swings. We tried everything to get this baby out. And, you know, we'd spend like most days together. I'd go home because obviously we didn't want to, you know, because wanting to honor God, both having made mistakes before with other people, we wanted to honor God and, you know, not like sleep together or anything before we were married. So we tried everything, and the days started ticking down, and suddenly it was the day before I was supposed to go back again. I was like, oh man, the baby's not going to come, and it's going to be the goodbye and all this pain all over again. Like, and again, like, I didn't want to like say, God, what are you doing? But part of me felt like saying that. And do you know what? The night before I was supposed to go, the baby came. And not only did he come, but he came so quickly that he ended up being born in my old bedroom in their house. My mum's a doctor, so my mum and her mum and the paramedics delivered the baby. Obviously, we weren't married, so I stayed well away from the business end of things. But it was just amazing, you know. And the paramedics let me cut the cord when he was out. And there I was, you know, a few weeks before, sitting on that tyre crying, thinking that God had sort of designed the worst way to hurt me. But if that hadn't happened, my boss wouldn't have taken pity on me and allowed me to be home for the birth of the guy that is now my son, Jacob. And because it was the last night before I was due back, my boss said, oh, you can't come back tomorrow. Have another 2 weeks off. It was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. So, yeah, as I say, they're all sitting on that tie crying, thinking that God had designed a perfect way to hurt me. But if he hadn't let that pain happen, that amazing thing of me being there for his birth couldn't have happened. So again, you never know. And so, like, that's a very easy, like, cut and dried, you know, dark time, happy ending. Sometimes we don't get the benefit of seeing how God has used some of the worst pain in our life. But again, the Bible promises us that God works all things, everything, that's not just like some things, all things together for the good of those that love him. So if you love him, whatever you go through in your life, whether it's cancer or like bankruptcy or anything like that, you know that you can trust in him because he's working it together for your good, even if you don't understand it at the time. And there are many things that have happened in my life where I don't still at this stage understand why he allowed it to happen. I know that he can be trusted. And I saw the rest of my time out there, and I desperately tried to avoid fighting, and I was largely successful, but I never got shot. And I came home, and we got married a few months later. And we've been married for a few years now. We've got another kid called Johnny, who's 4 years old. So, yeah, that was a story. And, like, I know that if you're sitting here now, you might be thinking, well, it's all right for you, isn't it? You know, like, you sort of got a happy ending, you know, like, my life isn't like that. Maybe you've lost someone really close to you, or your own personal outlook, either financially or health-wise, is looking bad. Well, the honest truth is this. Like I say, whatever you are going through, God can be trusted. I don't know if any of you heard at the weekend, last weekend, there was an amazing Christian guy in America called Nabil Qureshi. And he was a Muslim, a very devout Muslim, who converted to Christ. And he spent the rest of his days going around just telling everybody about Jesus. And last August, he contracted stomach cancer, really stage four, so very severe. And he passed away last Saturday, aged 34, 2 years older than me, with a wife and a kid. And you'd look at Nabil and say, Lord, why didn't you let him like live? Just think of all the things he could have done for you. But God had other plans. And even in his last, because like Nabil like vlogged his whole process of cancer, and even like to his last video message, even though you could see him being ravaged by the disease, he knew that God could be trusted. Even though he didn't make sense to him at the time, he knew God could be trusted. And that's my message to you. Whatever you're going through, whatever you're facing, God can be trusted, and he will work together all things for your good. He just wants you to love him and trust him. And I promise you, you know, I've done so many things in my life. I've been in like one of the most elite units in the army. I've had my footage shown all over the world. None of that is remotely as glorious and as satisfying as knowing God. So if you don't know him, please speak to the pastor, speak to one of the regulars here and ask him, how can I get to know this God? How can I get to know this Jesus who came and died for me? Because there is no better thing on earth that you can do. Anyway, thank you for listening to me. You've been very patient. And I don't think anybody dozed off either, so thank you.